Join us for a visit to the birthplace of PlanetVac this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. PlanetVac, a way to collect samples on other worlds that uses little more than compressed gas and one moving part. Bruce Batts and I will drop by Honeybee Robotics for a tour with two of the young engineers that are creating this cool new device, and Bruce will rejoin us for What's Up, naturally. Have you heard? The Planetary Society solar sail may rocket into orbit as soon as June of this year. Jason Davis is the Society's embedded reporter in the LightSail project. Jason, there is exciting news about LightSail 2. Looks like we're getting closer.
Yes, we are getting closer. This kind of infinite delay cycle that we've been on waiting for the Falcon Heavy to launch finally ended. And now we have an early launch period. We found out recently that the launch is tentatively scheduled to occur during a 60-day period that starts on June 13th of this year. So, yeah, we're getting close.
Now, you use the phrase launch period. That is as opposed to or quite different from a launch window, right?
Yeah. So, as I understand it, and Bruce Betts, our director of science and tech, was quick to point this out. Usually, when we say a window, we mean the specific time period in which the launch is actually going to happen. And that could be like a day-to-day scale of a couple hours. In this case, it's a period. And this means kind of the range that the Air Force has booked the launch pad and the launch range. I was trying to avoid using the word range twice there. This refers to the time that they're going to try to launch it in, essentially. It's during this 60-day period. And it could happen early on in that period or later. We don't actually have a specific target date yet. And of course, as we always say, it could slip beyond that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that I wasn't the only one becoming somewhat impatient. But I guess with that brilliant success of the first Falcon Heavy, things are looking good.
Yeah, there was a question of whether or not we were going to be the second flight or the third flight, and that seems to have been resolved. You know, things started moving quickly. LightSail and Prox 1 have to go to Albuquerque and get integrated there. That's where the Air Force Research Lab is, and that's who's has the primary payload on this flight. They started throwing out dates pretty fast to get the team moving, which was great news for us because the spacecraft has really just been sitting in storage all this time.
Remind us, where is LightSail right now?
Right now, it's back up at Cal Poly in storage there. Starting next week, I believe that the working date they're working with right now is Monday, they're going to put the spacecraft in the actual P-Pod, and that's the little spring-loaded carrier that will push it out into space, and that whole carrier goes inside Prox 1. So they do that first at Cal Poly, put it in the P-Pod. Then they're going to ship the entire unit to Albuquerque, and that's expected to happen the same week, next week. And then they'll plug it in there. Now, after that, it goes through some final integration testing and some environmental testing. And then they kind of pull the spacecraft out one last time to make sure it survived and it's still alive. As soon as late April, the entire unit, Prox 1 and LightSail, could ship to Florida. So we're getting close.
Wow. It really is very exciting. Thank you, Jason. We'll continue to follow your chronicling of the LightSail 2 mission at planetary.org. And of course, I hope you'll be visiting here on a regular basis too. And then comes the launch. Boy, I sure hope I'm down there in Florida to witness those 27 Falcon Heavy engines doing their thing.
Yeah, me too. We should all go and we'll breathe a sigh of relief once that thing gets off the pad.
And how? Jason Davis, he is a digital editor for the Planetary Society, and for our purposes today, far more important and significant that he is our embedded reporter with the LightSail project from the Planetary Society. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, Matt.
Sample return. It is the holy grail of planetary science. It's also very hard to accomplish. You have to reach another world, which is no small feat. Then you have to come all the way back to Earth. In between, you hope and pray that your sample collection system will work as planned. They don't always. So when Honeybee Robotics conceived of a radically simple way to pick up loose material on almost any surface, the Planetary Society became intrigued. The name PlanetVac almost says it all. So it was just a few days ago that I jumped in the car with Planetary Society Chief Scientist Bruce Betts and drove the 10 minutes it took to get to Honeybee's Pasadena facilities. By the way, Bruce took a lot of great photos during our tour. You can see some on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio.
Hey, Matt, look around. We're at Honeybee Robotics, and look, there are people to meet.
And this is a part of Honeybee that I've never been in. You guys have been growing. Introduce yourselves.
I'm Justin Spring, Senior Project Engineer and Main Engineer for PlanetVac right now.
I'm Catherine Luchek. I'm a regular project engineer, and I'm helping out with PlanetVac and Masten testing as well.
Where are we headed?
We're going to head right now into the main shop and show you guys some cool hardware and some PlanetVac prototypes.
Excellent. Let's go. I'll follow you.
It's gone.
Oh my God.
Where'd they move it?
What's gone?
How do you steal deep drill?
Someone stole PlanetVac?
No, the planetary deep drill used to be right here. I know you guys helped us out with that. I always like to show that off. It's kind of fun to walk through the door and say, now turn around, and there it is. But it's gone. I bet they put it in the other building. So we'll have to go find that later on our extended tour.
We probably should check the Smithsonian.
I got a great photo of your boss and me holding deep drill up somewhere around here. Nice shop.
Thank you. So as we said, we do have a bigger drone. It's right there.
Oh, man. That is a big drone.
That is a big drone. So we use this one for collecting sample for far off places. You can see we've got the scoop there on the bottom that we made. It's kind of like your claw game, except instead of a crane, you have a sky crane, if you will. You fly to the destination you want. You look through the camera, see a material you want to pick up, grab it, fly it back. The idea for this is, say there's a place that you want to take a sample from and it's dangerous or it's too far off, like a volcano, a geologist working in that kind of environment. Just fly the drone in, grab a sample, bring it back. We've also considered stuff like search and rescue for stuff like this. Fly it off, see if an area has radiation in it by grabbing a sample, pulling it back to analyze instead of sending humans in. We put that up there for the dramatic effect.
My parents are so lucky that you guys didn't develop this till now, because if I had seen this as a kid, I would never have given up telling them I want one.
Well, if you want one, there's a hefty price tag on that guy, but they are commercially available. This model here is usually used for film industry. They put a big, hefty camera on it, and there's some cool videos online of it, like chasing a car around a parking lot. It's pretty cool. So we're going to bring you over here into the restricted zone.
We're special.
You're very special. Our group here, we do a lot of pneumatic sampling, not just specifically for PlanetVac, but for other projects. And so because we're working on other projects back here that are, we'll say, sensitive, we get the nice black curtain that hides us from everyone else. Here we have our Box-O PlanetVac, which is full of various iterations of the sampler. And actually, we'll go down and see one that I've been testing even up to this morning. Yep, that's a good one. That's a good one, too.
One of the things I love about PlanetVac now, this iteration, are the colors. It's like, I half expect you to tell me that Dyson Vacuum Cleaners has called you up, and they want to see if they can license the design and the color scheme.
We can see here kind of a time progression of general PlanetVac technology. So if you look at this one on the left, it looks like a tube with small holes in the center. This is like the one from, what was it, 2015, Bruce? From way back then. Was it earlier?
Well, and all of these must be later generations than where we started, right? With the little one that was in the vacuum. Mm-hmm. I don't recognize any of this hardware.
Well, we actually started with you and a straw, as I recall. But then we moved on and Honeybee made it, you know, more official. But yes, there's been a lot of progress and a lot of development of these pneumatic samplers from Honeybee Robotics.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Honeybee in general has over a decade of research behind pneumatic sampling.
The principle remains the same, right?
You can do this stuff on virtually any surface, even in a vacuum, because you're bringing along your own gas to stir stuff up and suck it up into the sample compartment.
Right? So it doesn't necessarily matter what the atmosphere is like. The basic concept of this is just like your vacuum cleaner at home. You have an area of low pressure and an area of high pressure. High pressure wants to flow to the low pressure. So in your vacuum cleaner at home, your pump in there is making an area of low pressure to suck up the material into your bag or bagless if you have it. Here in PlanetVac, if we have it in a vacuum chamber, well, the low pressure is already provided. And all you have to do is provide the high pressure, whoosh, goes to the low pressure, done. If you're on a celestial body like Titan that has higher pressure than we already have here, well, then you could do it in reverse, where, say, instead of bringing a compressed air tank, you bring a vacuum tank. And then you let that loose and sucks it right up. Or you could try to make a higher pressure at the nozzles, which is also possible.
Remind us why this is such an attractive solution compared to the many other technologies that have been discussed for sample recovery, sample collection. Catherine?
Well, it's not so much a mechanical system. A lot of your sample collection and sample return is very complicated in the mechanisms that they use in order to take a core of material. If you're drilling on Mars, we've seen a lot of things breaking down mechanically in places where we can't fix them. And so this is really nice in that there is nothing that's moving. There's no claws, there's no drills. You are putting air into a system to force a sample collection mechanism.
So it's really not much more than just a valve, right, to open up the flow from whatever tank you're using.
Correct. And that valve could be mechanical, like a solenoid valve. It could also be a explosive valve like they use on many spacecraft. Basically, pop it once and it's open. So you can imagine, say, you had a lander like the Maston lander, but all 4 feet were a sampler, and you wanted to up your chances. Well, you could have 4 air tanks, each with their own one-time use valve. Fire the first one. Does it work? Yes. Okay. You don't need to fire the other ones. Well, did it not work? Okay. Well, try another one. Try another one. And that could super simple, super easy to just strap right on basically any sort of lander.
Where to from here?
We are going to go to the next building. I can show you where we're currently testing the current version of PlanetVac.
When we return, Bruce Betts and I will go inside Honeybee Robotics' giant freezer and hear PlanetVac in action. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Hi, this is Casey Dreyer, the Director of Space Policy here at the Planetary Society, and I wanted to let you know that right now Congress is debating the future of NASA's budget. The House has proposed to increase NASA's budget and also increase planetary science in 2018. The Senate, however, has proposed to cut both. You can make your voice heard right now. We've made it easy to learn more if you go to planetary.org/petition2017. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, continuing our tour of Honeybee Robotics in Pasadena, California. Honeybee has built all sorts of hardware for planetary science missions. It has also spent years developing PlanetVac technology for sample return. Project engineers Justin Spring and Catherine Lukchek were about to bring Bruce Betts and me to another building used by the company. You'll hear not only about PlanetVac, but also about another innovative project the Planetary Society has supported and that Planetary Radio has reported on. That's Planetary Deep Drill. That is a wonderful looking rig.
This guy here, you should recognize, this is the Planetary Deep Drill. This is the deployment stage for the next generation Planetary Deep Drill. And actually, you can see it's over there on the table. Huh. You see that it has gotten beefier. This is where our vacuum chambers live.
All of them.
All of them. And also our freezers. So
wow.
You can see we've got from very big. This is our extra large Mars chamber. It's a couple meters tall. You could fit a phone booth inside and still have room for another phone booth probably. They dropped it from about mid-height here into a bin of simulant. If you like fun facts, that bin full of sand is the same bin that the Mars simulant was for the original Planet Vac.
Random space fact!
How close can you come to duplicating the vacuum of space, or let's say on the surface of the moon?
So this large chamber here, this is a Mars chamber. So we can get down to Mars pressure in about 15 minutes.
Really cool toys. Now you were leaning against, gotta be the freezer.
The giant freezer with the really tall section to fit the planetary deep drill in.
Are you serious? That is also part of the freezer that goes way up, like 20 feet up?
Yeah, that's still part of the freezer, almost all the way to the ceiling in here, so that we can fit the entire planetary deep drill in here to do testing in ice.
We open the door here.
It's kind of loud.
It's very cold.
Oh, yes it is.
But you can see there's a workbench in here. At one point, that stand there had a drill on it. All of these are for drilling into. They're big 50-gallon barrels full of ice. We even have these clear ice blocks that you can see as you drill into. But yeah, you can see up in here, that's where the planetary deep drill would go. And it's cold. It's very cold.
In case you were missing your shoes.
All right, I'm coming next year for White Christmas if I can't get up to the mountains. You were very excited. You said you have a fun story.
I do. We worked with a professor at Caltech when I was doing testing in our really small vacuum chamber to see if a potato plant would survive in the vacuum chamber at Mars pressure for 24 hours. That potato plant is now living in her garden, and it's fine.
No kidding!
Yeah.
So the Martian, he could have kept eating taters.
Potentially. I mean, I understand it's critical to the timeline of the story, but the pressure and the temperature do not affect the potato plants quite as drastically as in the book.
Because if Andy Weir doesn't know this, I'm going to tell him. The thing we haven't talked about is what's going to happen. This amazing test that is going to be taking place soon in the Mojave, Bruce?
In the Mojave Desert, yes, indeed, outside of the thriving metropolis of Mojave.
You're going to strap this thing to a rocket.
Once Planet Vac is done and ready to go, we're going to take their rocket, we're going to lift it up, we're going to pull its feet off and put Planet Vac on, and it's going to become the feet of the rocket. We're going to take it out to the desert, to their launch pad. We're going to launch it, translate over into our sample bin, land partially in the sample bin, collect sample, and then lift off again, go back to the pad, and land again.
You said feet. That's news to me. Are there going to be multiple Planet Vacs on this test bed?
So there's only going to be one that we're testing with. The other three are going to be the same shape for just symmetry for landing the Maston rocket, but they're not actually going to be active.
Can you tell me more about the Maston Zodiac, Bruce?
It's a rocket, obviously, by Maston Space Systems that's designed to basically hover. So it simulates planetary landers, essentially. And they use it to test various equipment in more realistic environments. So in this case, taking Planet Vac, which has been tested in various forms in places like vacuum chambers, and actually testing it in a rocket environment to demonstrate that it can handle the stresses and the vibration and actually work in that environment, which will get it one step closer to being selected to actually fly on planetary spacecraft.
What do you think it'll feel like if someday you see a spacecraft arrive on some mysterious body in our solar system, and on its foot, or several of its feet, are Planet Vac descendants ready to collect some of that that material, that alien material?
That is such an impact on space flight and sample collection that it's almost hard to imagine having. Being in my 20s, like seeing something 20 years from now that I worked on at its conception is almost mind-blowing.
Justin?
Well, I get really excited when I see my 3D printed model on YouTube, so I can only imagine how excited I'll be to see it on a real spacecraft.
Bruce, thanks for making me part of the road trip. This has been great fun.
This has been great fun, and we're always happy to come by and visit with Honeybee and partner with them and do good stuff like innovative technologies for the future of space travel.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Catherine, for the great tour.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So even though we just spent quite a bit of time with Bruce at Honeybee Robotics, here we are online, ready to talk to the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. There's that great new title.
Yay.
for this week's edition of What's Up. And, you know, we talked with Jason about the news about light sail. You must be excited.
I am excited. You know, I've been working on this for years, so we're looking forward to a launch, and we've got this 60-day period opening June 13th is great.
Yeah, and of course, they do slip. Don't hold your breath, anybody, but we are certainly anxious and excited. We're also so excited about the night sky.
As well you should be, Matt. You know, in the early evening when you're looking for Venus super low but super bright in the west, shortly after sunset, you might be able to pick out Mercury in the next several days, a little below and to the side of Venus, much dimmer. Looks like a bright star normally, but it'll be a little tougher in the sunset glare. Also, Jupiter coming up around the middle of the night, and then followed by Mars and Saturn all rising in the east, of course. And on March 10th, you can see the moon between Mars and Saturn.
And stay tuned, because Mercury is coming up again in a moment or two.
All right, we move on to this week in space history. You know what happened in 1781, Matt? That's right.
Let's see. No.
William Herschel discovered Uranus.
Wow, right in the middle of the Revolutionary War. Was it over by then? I guess it was over by then.
It ended that year. But I don't think that affected William Herschel too much, but maybe it did. I don't know. I shouldn't go where I don't know. But what I do know is that he discovered Uranus in 1781. This week, we shall move on to...
Hello, Space Fact.
I think that was a William Herschel impression.
Yes, he had a speech impediment. In honor of William Herschel discovering Uranus, I'm pulling out one of my most immature random space facts in a very long time. If you started from your bathroom on Earth, you would need 47.64 billion rolls of toilet paper to reach Uranus. And that's standard size 2-ply. We want it to be comfortable in space.
How appropriate, since Uranus is also going to come up momentarily when we get to the trivia question.
It's nice of you to say that, but I don't think there's anything appropriate about that.
You know, my old astronomy professor, he did say that it's pronounced Uranus. This is not an anatomy class, he added.
It's certainly pronounced Uranus for all of us who try to maintain any seriousness about a serious planet with cool stuff that happens there.
Not the last time we will mispronounce it, I will warn you up front. But go on, let's get into the contest.
All right, I asked you, what two planets in our solar system have about the same surface gravity? How'd we do, Matt?
It was really split between people who said, the one I think you were primarily looking for, surprisingly, to me anyway, Mercury and Mars, because Mercury is so much smaller than Mars, right?
Right, but it's denser, and so the equations work out. You got the mass of Mars and Mercury being different and the radii being different, but when you do the gravity calculation, they're both about 0.38 Earth gravity, 0.38 G.
So the other one that a lot of people submitted, and we would have accepted, but didn't have to because our winner was one of those who said Mercury and Mars. The other possibility was Venus and Uranus. There were people, of course, who said, how could it be Uranus? It doesn't have a surface. Please explain.
Well, that's why I was looking for Mars and Mercury with my statement of surface gravity. But indeed, you can calculate the gravitational attraction at any point for a planet. And so if you pick roughly the top of the atmosphere, the top of the cloud tops, say, on Uranus, and then do the gravity calculation, it's 0.9 G-ish, which is about the same as Venus if you're on the surface of Venus.
Tricky one. At least that was the feeling of our winner this week. He's a new listener. We had just heard that he started listening to the show a week or two ago. It's Andrew Jones of Goleta, California. Go UCSB. So, Andrew, congratulations. You have won yourself a Planetary Society t-shirt and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. Because our poet laureate is taking a well-earned vacation this week, we got this from Kay Gilbert in Manhattan Beach, California. Here is a comparison that's not the least bit heinous. The surface gravity's quite close on Venus and Uranus. So if you want to bounce a bit and feel some extra freeness, you'll celebrate your lesser weight on Uranus or Venus. I told you to come up again.
You did. You did. I wondered about your foreshadowing and your motifs. Anyway. Well, I'm going to move on to a much more straightforward and probably boring question, but our listeners make every question interesting. How many missions carried humans to space as part of the NASA Mercury program? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Wow. Okay. Very, very good. This is one that you have until the 14th. That would be Wednesday, March 14 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to win. Get yourself in the contest anyway. I'm not saying you're going to win. Only one person is going to be chosen by random.org, and that person better have the right answer. And if they do, they're going to get a Planetary Society t-shirt. By the way, we're going to go back to Planetary Radio t-shirts before long. This t-shirt and the Planetary Radio t-shirt both come to us from Chop Shop. You can check out the Planetary Society store at chopshopstore.com. And my gosh, a 200-point iTelescope.net account from the people...
Oh my gosh.
From the people behind that terrific network of telescopes all over our planet, operated on a nonprofit basis. That's iTelescope.net. And you can donate that account as well to your local astronomy club or a school or whomever you choose. I don't know who you would choose, but I choose to believe that we're done.
I choose to say, hey, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about palm trees and the sun. Thank you, and good night.
Got some right outside my window. Thank you, Bruce. He is the chief scientist for the Planetary Society. He used to be the director of science and technology. I don't know if this is a move up or sideways or, you know. Anyway.
It's a new title with more areas of responsibility. Yay!
He joins us every week here for What's Up. I'll be on the road a lot over the next several weeks. First stop is a return to Southern Illinois University for the March 24th premiere of the Total Solar Eclipse documentary shot there last fall. Then I'll join the Yuri's Night Los Angeles celebration on April 7th, once again partying under Space Shuttle Endeavour at the California Science Center. May 8 to 10 brings this year's Humans to Mars Summit from Explore Mars with an amazing lineup of space leaders in Washington, D.C. And then there's the National Space Society's International Space Development Conference, May 24 to 27 in Los Angeles. All of these are open to anyone. We've got more information on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its globe-spanning members. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.